afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. This is Mark Levine reporting live to you from the Center for American Progress. We've got a great guest coming up in just a few minutes. He is the Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs. So he's a very important guy. His name is Robert Shapiro. And we're going to get a little wonky. We're going to talk about the economy and specifically about the role of the Federal Reserve, the role of the central banks. And I think it's important that really every American understand exactly what they do. Some of the Ron Paul types seem to think that the Federal Reserve is part of this vast conspiracy theory. I don't know whether it's the Bilderberg group or the, aliens landing in New Mexico, Roswell, whatever it is. It's a part of all conspiracy theories. Actually, what it does is it controls the nation's money supply. And it's got a tough job because the more you increase the money supply, the more you take a risk of inflation. But if you don't increase the money supply enough, then you have high unemployment. Because when there's more money circulating, that allows people to get raises, that allows people to hire people. And macroeconomic theory, and I do have a degree in this stuff, macroeconomic theory is quite clear that the more you increase the money supply, the more you increase economic growth and actually low unemployment. Money, if you will, is the grease that keeps all the gears moving. And the Federal Reserve, since 2009, has done just that. It has greased the wheels. It has increased the money supply. It has protected us from the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression, the Bush recession of 2008, a financial panic, as it were. A financial recession is always the worst kind, which is why the Great Depression was the worst. And Chairman Bernanke of the Federal Reserve did, I think, a very good job in helping us get out of it. But we're not out of it yet. It takes time to get out of financial recessions. And we're going to go after all these details with Robert Shapiro. That's coming up in just 10 minutes. Before I get there, though, I got to make a little comment about Burger King. I was on the Sean Hannity show today. It's going to be aired later on. You can find out details at my website, marklevinetalk.com. And Sean was defending Burger King. Burger King, as many of you know, is an American company that is buying a Canadian company called Tim Hortons, a fast food chain. And I got no problem with that. If Burger King wants to buy Tim Hortons, that's fine. I do have a problem, though, that they're moving their headquarters from the United States to Canada to avoid paying U.S. corporate taxes. Now I got a problem. In fact, Burger King isn't even the worst offender. There are American companies that are doing things like moving to Bermuda or the Cayman Islands or Ireland, all countries with very, very low tax rates, and they do maybe 1% of their business in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda or Ireland, and they still are moving their corporate headquarters there just to avoid U.S. taxes. In most cases, it may be one person down there in the islands. It may even just be a post office box. They are doing this, and the question that Sean Hannity asked me is, do I think it's unpatriotic? And I said, I think it's unpatriotic to have laws that legally allow them to do this. I understand why companies are doing it. If a bank leaves all its money out there, a whole bunch of cash on tables, and says, take what you will, a lot of people are going to take the money. I just don't think a bank should leave the money out there in the public and allow people to take what they will. Just like I don't think American law should allow a company that does 90% of its business in America and 10% of its business in Canada. I don't think that we should allow that company to pay 100% of its taxes to Canada. You do 90% of business in America, pay 90% of corporate taxes to America. You know what? You do 10% of your business in Canada, by all means. By all means, take 10% of your profits, take the taxes on your Canadian profits and pay taxes in Canada. But your taxes on your American profits should go to America. I think that's a patriotic thing to do. And Sean was going on and on about, well, you know, if someone is rich and dying, in order to avoid the estate tax, they should just pack up and leave America. I think that's un-American. Now, that doesn't mean it's not legal. There are plenty of things that are legal that are wrong. Citizens United says that you can donate hundreds of millions of dollars and you can do so secretly and anonymously in order to control the electoral system. It is now legal. It is still wrong. So is Burger King doing something to help its bottom line? Sure. Is it un-American? Well, It's taking advantage of an un-American loophole. And I'm against it. Because we are losing $20 billion. $20 billion off these corporations that are changing their corporate headquarters. Now, that's money that can go to all kinds of things. It can go to whatever you want. It can go to the Affordable Care Act. It can go to roads. It can go to bridges. Heck, for Sean Hannity, he'd probably want it to go to some new fighter. I don't know. But the point, maybe to pay down the national debt, whatever it is, how can someone who claims to be a patriotic American support laws that allow businesses to pack up, take the money they earn in America, and give that taxes to another country? I mean, I love Canada. It's a great country. It's our best ally. It's our best trading partner. Quebec, Toronto, lovely places. But I'm an American, and I'm an American first. And I think that companies that do business in America should pay for that privilege. After all, they drive on American roads, and they feed Americans. And if Americans are getting out of shape because they're eating a lot of fast food from Burger King, then at the very least, Burger King could pay taxes to America to pay for the health care to treat those Americans that are out of shape. So I strongly disagree with all these conservatives. They wrap themselves in the American flag. They say they're patriotic, and yet they don't want American companies to pay taxes in America. See, they say the tax rate is too high. I say whatever tax rate the American people through their elected representatives decide, whatever it is, I think American companies should pay it. Period. I don't think they should be able to use some fancy loophole and some lawyers to get out of paying for the privilege of doing business in America. This is Mark Levine. Be right back right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. The stock market yesterday hit a new high. If you follow that kind of thing, the S&P index hit over 2,000 for the first time in American history. If you are an investor, if you've got lots of money in stocks, you're doing very well. And if you're the rest of the country, you're not doing so well. That's the problem in America. We have economic growth like we've never believed, and corporate profits that are great. Corporations avoiding American taxes are doing even better, and ordinary people are struggling. And the question is, when a central bank like the Federal Reserve looks at something like that, a growing economy for some, an uneven economy, an economy where the rich are richer than their wildest dreams and middle-class people are struggling to get by, what can it do? What should it do? To help answer those questions, I have a really distinguished guest. He is the Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs in America. He is also the chairman of an economic advisory firm named Sonicon. His name is Robert Shapiro. Robert, or should I call you Bob? Welcome to the show.
Call me Rob.
Call you Rob.
Happy to be here. I used to talking with Leslie, and I'm delighted to talk to you.
Well, it's my privilege to have you here, and I'm a real wonk myself, but you've out-wonked me, and that's always my privilege to have really intelligent people on the show. So before you came on, I explained how Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve had basically expanded the money supply. The technical term is quantitative easing for all you wonks out there. But basically expanded the monetary supply, kept interest rates low, and actually kept us from going into an even greater depression in 2008. Now they're laying off. And I guess the question for you is the same question I posed to the public. How can the Federal Reserve, or can the Federal Reserve, help income inequality, the people, middle class people who are struggling? Or is it basically, you know, pedal to the metal that all the economy improves or breaks and all the economy goes back, and they can't really distinguish between the rich who are doing extremely well and the middle class that's struggling?
Look, there's nothing the Fed can do about the kind of structural changes in the economy that have shifted a lot of income to upper income people. That doesn't mean they can't do things which will disproportionately help the non-rich.
Give me some examples of those.
Okay. Well, the biggest example is, as opposed to wealthy people, most people, the only real asset they have is the home equity in
right.
their homes.
Right.
You know, 93% of the value of all financial assets in the country are held by the top 20%. That means that the bottom 80% holds 7% of the value of all financial assets. That's all bank accounts, all pensions, all stocks and bonds, et cetera. Most Americans have little or no financial assets. The asset they have is their homes.
And by the way, their homes, what percent of Americans own their homes? We're not even talking half, 60%?
No, it's a little over 60%.
Okay, so 40% have virtually nothing.
That's correct.
Okay, and then we're talking about an additional 40% or so. Yeah, we're talking about an additional 40% that own their own homes, and then you said that the top 20% own.
60% own their own homes, and now of those, you know, we were setting aside the top 20%.
Right.
So that's 40% of the country.
Right.
And keeping long-term interest rates low, which was what the quantitative easing program was about. You know, the normally Fed interventions affect short-term interest rates. The quantitative easing, what made it different was that it was targeted to long-term interest rates. Normally, we left the markets determine long-term interest rates. And so by targeting long-term interest rates, the rate that they were really targeting was the mortgage rate.
Basically a 30-year bond, a traditional, when you buy a house, you get a 30-year mortgage.
Correct.
That's what they're doing.
And 20- and 30-year bonds.
Okay.
Right.
20- and 30-year. And so has
so
this helped the housing market?
That has helped. That is, you know, the most recent report said that home prices rose by 5% over the last year nationally, more in some areas, less in others. But the fact is, if you've got, you know, if you're a middle-class family and you've got $25,000 in equity in your home, you've just made $1,250.
Sure, and your interest rates have gone down.
Increase.
From
right.
7 or 8% down to 3 or 4%, and that's a significant monthly check that you save when you're paying off your mortgage.
You also save in what you pay on your mortgage, right? I was looking at the wealth effects. That is, the low long-term rates are supporting the housing market, and the housing market, so long as it's supported, values go up, and as values go up, anybody who holds a house gets a little richer. Look, we just came through a period of the opposite of that, where we saw a collapse in housing values and a sharp contraction in the wealth of middle-class people because the value of their home equity just went down.
Okay, but now we have a new Federal Reserve Chairman, Janet Yellen.
Yes.
She just met in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The purpose
yes.
of the Federal Reserve is twofold, as I explained to be in the broadcast. One is to keep unemployment down, but the other is to keep inflation down. And
yes.
if you keep expanding the monetary supply for too long, eventually, as unemployment goes down, inflation goes up. So the Federal Reserve has announced that they're going to slow down this quantitative easing, I guess end it, reverse it, actually. And the real question I have for you, of course, is does that undo this great support for the housing market that you just talked about?
We'll have to see. We'll have to see. That is, they have been reducing quantitative easing now for, you know, about 8 months.
Yeah.
And it's gone from $85 billion a month down to, I think, about 35. And they're going to continue, and they expect to continue to unwind it. I'll tell you, we'll see whether the market really needed that. And it may be that, you know, there are lots of factors which affect both the price of housing and interest rates.
Okay, but you're my expert, so I can ask you to make predictions that I don't have to make. See, that's the advantage of me being the talk show host and you being the expert. So I'm going to ask you to make a prediction. If quantitative easing over the next year goes to zero, and by the way, will it go to zero in a year?
It'll go to zero within 3 months.
Within 3 months. So it's going to end entirely in 3 months.
That's correct.
How will that affect housing prices 3-4 years down the road? That's a tough question, but hey, like I said, I get to ask them.
I actually think that the quantitative easing was necessary a year ago and 2 years ago. I think that interest rates are going to edge up, in assuming that the economy continues to grow. You know, the other, you know, there are lots of sources of demand for long-term loans. Home mortgages is one. But business investment is another. And so if the economy continues to pick up, you know, you'll see more borrowing for business investment, and that puts pressure on interest rates as well because it's more demand.
So,
And since we're not expanding the supply through quantitative easing.
Rob, I'm going to a break. The heart of it is you think we'll be okay.
I do think we'll be okay.
You think we'll be okay, even though quantitative easing is going down. That's good to hear. Yeah. When we come back after break, I want to ask you about how we're doing versus the rest of the world, because for all the problems in America, it seems like everyone else is doing a lot worse. Europe, for sure. Japan, definitely. Even China is not doing as well. What are we doing right here that they're not doing right abroad, and why don't Americans feel it and recognize the good our government is doing compared to the rest of the world? If you want to call in and... please do. 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. Be right back after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. I'm talking right now with Rob Shapiro. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs. So you know he knows what he's talking about. And we're talking some wonky stuff. But it's important because there's a lot of mystery around the Federal Reserve, our central bank, the people who print our money, the people who control interest rates. Frankly, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you hate the Federal Reserve. I have no problem with the Federal Reserve. It, like any other branch of government, can do a good job. It can do a bad job. You know, people say they like or they don't like Obama or Bush, but you don't hear people saying, I hate the presidency. You know what? They're good presidents and they're bad presidents. There's good Fed chairman, bad Fed chairman. But it sounds to me, and I want to know if you agree with me, Rob, that the Fed did something right because, correct me if I'm wrong again, America is doing better than virtually any Western industrialized economy right now, and that includes Europe and Japan. Am I right?
Absolutely. The Fed performed much better than the European Central Bank or the Bank of Japan. In the aftermath of the crisis, we were much more aggressive in monetary ease than Europe or Japan. We were also more aggressive than Europe or Japan in fiscal ease, in budgetary ease initially.
Now, when you say budgetary ease, let me put this in people's terms, because that means basically it was right to spend a lot of money when we did. When we did that stimulus package, it was crucial. Because folks, I remember conservatives opposed the stimulus package. Right. Many of them opposed quantitative easing. They opposed the Federal Reserve easing monetary supply. They wanted austerity. They wanted us to cut the budget. They wanted us to cut spending. They wanted us to cut the money supply. And we have real life comparisons, right? Isn't that what Great Britain did, for example?
Yes, absolutely. We have real-life comparisons. We also have, you know, a corpus of economic thinking. There was no economic argument for austerity. Zero.
But Great Britain did it. Why?
It did not exist in modern economics. This was the substitution of political ideology for economics.
You know, it's funny. I went on conservative talk shows. I went on O'Reilly's show. And I said, I have a degree in macroeconomics. I studied it at Harvard. I mean, I don't usually pull out my credentials, but I mean, ISLM curves. I know this stuff, and I know what increases economic growth. And there's two ways. One is more spending, and the other is monetary easing. It's actually it's kind of macroeconomics 101. And they were coming up with these wild ideas and theories that maybe if we balance the budget that we would somehow help economic growth. And I said, that's what Herbert Hoover tried.
Exactly.
And it didn't work for him. Why do you think it would work for Obama?
Right. Well, of course, it didn't have anything to do with economics. It only had to do with politics and political ideology. We would have done better had we continued the stimulus, had the stimulus been larger at the beginning, and had it persisted, had we been able to come back 2 years later with more. We need it today. We need more stimulus today. The deficit has been falling very rapidly.
Right, from $1 trillion to under $500 billion.
It's now a small percentage of GDP. This is precisely the time, you know, when you can borrow for 2% for 20 years.
Yeah.
This is the time to borrow in order to invest in the infrastructure,
roads,
in order to
bridges,
invest in education,
sure,
in order to invest in R&D. This is what we did in the 50s and 60s, incidentally.
But, Rob, here's the thing. Some people, and one of the things I like about Leslie's audience is that she gets about one-third conservatives, two-thirds liberals. Love my liberals, but I also like my conservatives that listen to the show. And they're going to dismiss everything you and I say as this ivory tower intellectual claptrap. And so what I want to do is I want to give them real-life examples to show this isn't some theory out of Harvard. What this is basically the way the world works. So compare U.S. growth with Great Britain. As I recall, United Kingdom practiced tremendous austerity over the last 5-6 years. Explain what happened there. Why did they do it, and what's happening with their economy?
Well, what happened was that Britain and continental Europe as well went back into recession. We came out of the recession before the end of 2009. The economy was growing again. In Europe and in Japan, they came out, and then they went back into recession. They were back into recession in 2012.
Because they didn't have enough government spending.
Because they didn't have enough demand.
Right, but
they
the demand that we had was not from consumers. Consumers were watching their home prices drop. They were not shopping. They were not spending money on Christmas toys. It was the government that supplied that demand in America with President Obama's stimulus package that saved our economy. They didn't do that in Great Britain.
Right, and even this year, the growth in the United States, which won't be as strong as we'd like it to be, is going to be about double the growth in the Eurozone. And into 2015, according to the OECD predictions, according to the Conference Board predictions, according to the IMF predictions, the fact of the matter is we are growing a lot faster. Part of this is fiscal policy. Part of it is also the other favorite issue of some of your conservative listeners. Part of it is immigration. You know, we have Europe and Japan have very serious demographic problems, by which I mean
they don't have enough new people in there working hard and making their economy grow. They've got
a
bunch of elderly to support, and because they're not taking in enough immigrants, they don't have people to do the jobs for them.
The fact is, the entire world, you know, what we have seen is that advanced countries have falling birth rates.
Right.
And when women have the opportunity to use birth control and the opportunity to be in the workforce, they choose to have much smaller families. That's the fact.
Right, which I support, by the way, because it's their freedom of choice. But the answer, of course, is immigration. And that provides a difference.
A lot of our answer. And it's one of the reasons, one of the critical reasons that our growth is faster. Now, the other reason is that we have a more entrepreneurial economy. And in this period, this entrepreneurism has been tied to the development and diffusion of new technologies. And these technologies have increased productivity. And we're talking mainly information technologies here. The growth is a function of how productive each worker is and the number of workers you have. We're adding more workers at a faster rate than Europe because we've also got immigration and the children of first-generation immigrants. whose birth rates are resemble more their home country than the United States. And we have also got faster productivity growth because we've been able to apply advanced technologies more effectively than Europe or Japan.
Rob, let me ask you this. Despite, I know what economics you're talking about. Like I said, I have a degree in it myself. By the way, you were Undersecretary of Commerce under which president, if you don't mind my asking?
Clinton.
Under Bill Clinton. Okay, so under a Democrat.
I was taught at Harvard by Janet Yellen.
There you go. And I was taught by Martin Feldstein, who was Ronald Reagan's chief counsel of economic advisors.
Marty was actually my dissertation director.
There you go. So people are always surprised that Ronald Reagan's head of economics was my professor, and I tell them that Marty Feldstein and I agree that government spending stimulates an economy and monetary increasing the money supply stimulates the economy, and they don't believe me. They don't believe me that Ronald Reagan's head economist agrees on what they consider liberal techniques. So my question for you, Rob, I'm going to move to a political question, not an economic one. My question for you is, people in America are falling for this conservative nonsense. Even the presidential candidates, you heard Mitt Romney. I'm not just talking about Rick Perry. I'm talking about Mitt Romney, supposedly the intelligent ones, going out there talking about why government spending is dangerous and the deficit's a real problem. And there's this idea, and it's not just among conservatives, even independents, even some liberals that say, I'm really, really worried about deficit spending. And I tell them in economic theory, you need to be worried about deficit spending when the economy is strong, when unemployment is low. That was our problem in Vietnam, 1960s and 70s. But when the economy is weak, we want deficit spending. And again, they look at me like I've got two heads. Why is it that Americans are so misinformed? I'll let you think about it and come back after the break with this answer.
Okay.
But I want to know why Americans are so misinformed, and is there really a significant difference between liberal economists and conservative economists? I would argue, when it comes to economic theory, the differences are tiny. They're minor, and conservatives are just misinformed. 888-653-7543. If you're one of those conservatives, and you hate the Federal Reserve, and you hate deficit spending, and you want to call in, please, let's have a pleasant discussion. 888-653-7543. Back with Rob Shapiro right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. Leslie will be joining me in about 15, 20 minutes or so. Right now, my guest is the former Undersecretary of Commerce under Bill Clinton for Economic Affairs. His name is Rob Shapiro. And we are getting together like two economic wonks. He's got a PhD in this stuff. I just have a bachelor's degree in it, so he knows it better than I do. But I did my thesis on macroeconomic theory because it actually fascinated me that people were getting this stuff so wrong. Basic economic theory has been shown that in hard times, you need government spending, you need stimulus, you also need basically to print more money. The technical term is quantitative easing, but basically it's putting more money in the money supply. My question for my guest, Rob Shapiro, is why do so many people get this wrong? Why do the politicians not know the truth, or are they basically manipulating people because they, for other reasons?
You know, we have the clearest example I can imagine of this right now in France, where there's a socialist government, and that has been pursuing austerity. And indeed, the kind of
cutting back on government spending, a socialist government. Why would they do that?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is, you know, they've got the ridiculous terms of the Eurozone.
Yeah, see, I think they have to keep up with Germany, basically, and Germany's imposing on everybody else.
Germany's preference, kind of atavistic preference for austerity. But I think behind this is something much larger, and that is there's general distrust of government. That's unsurprising. We had a disastrous war in Iraq. We had the collapse of the economy. We've had 15 years of income stagnation, even during expansions. And so the government, in the eyes of many, many people, has failed. Well, if the government has failed, it becomes very easy to attack anyone who wants to give the government more money. So the problem is that the public has seen the failure of national security planners in the White House and the Office of the Vice President and financial regulators. And they have generalized that to the entire government, that because
do you think most
the regulators got it wrong, no
right.
one will know how to fix a bridge.
Do you think that Ted Cruz, who for all we could say about him, is an intelligent guy,
sure.
he's well-educated, do you think Ted Cruz knows the truth, Rand Paul, Bobby Jindal, you name it, Mitt Romney, do you think they know the truth and are just trying to manipulate Americans? Or do you think they generally believe this nonsense that austerity, that cutting back on government spending in a time of recession, is good for the economy? Do you think they really believe it?
I'll tell you, I've spent a lot of time with national politicians, and they have a great capacity to believe whatever they think will serve their political interests.
See, that's what I think.
They can convince themselves of it. The question is, you know, that's the right on, the right wing with respect to austerity is easy to explain. Harder to explain is all the people on the left who also support it. And
give me some of those in America.
Well, you've got the Committee for a Balanced Budget, which is filled with Democrats. You have a lot of members of the U.S. Senate who, voted to not expand spending, voted for the sequester. We had
is that because it's just
president in America in the last 50 years who supported a sequester. So, in fact, you had the whole Democratic Party cutting the budget.
And that's, I guess, because, and you got Simpson-Bowles Commission comes to mind as well. But I think what you're saying is that it's good politics to say that you want to cut government spending, even though it's bad economics.
And it's good politics to make yourself as small a target as possible for your opponents.
And so it's good politics and bad
really
economics, but do you think we need better economic education in America? Or
yes,
do you think
we need better economic education. We need, a less tendentious media. We need statesmen. We don't have statesmen anymore. We don't even, and this was true of the Bush people. It's just as true of the Obama people. People come to Washington now with a new president, and they see it as a ticket to a very high-paying position.
Yeah.
And
the revolving door of politics.
And it's they become lobbyists, the top ones. They all go to Wall Street.
Right.
Like my former classmate Larry Summers.
Like the people I ran against when I ran for Congress, they're Democrats and they're all lobbyists. And I tried to say, that's not the kind of person I would be. And people were saying, how dare you attack these people? They're just making their living.
Right.
And I said, well,
they're not just making a living. They're making millions of dollars a year. But...
And they're ruining our system because no one should have secret access or special privileges in America. Everyone should be able to go to their representative with the exact same right, whether you're a homeless person living under a bridge or whether you're owner of a multimillion dollar corporation.
It's very
corrupting.
That's
not true, but I think it should be true. I think this is the way the world should work, even though
it
doesn't.
I mean, we had someone who was a consultant to President Clinton and to Vice President Gore and their campaigns, who is now advising Rick Perry on his indictment.
here's another question, though, because you talked a little bit about the media. When I go on Fox News or MSNBC, or even if I go on CNN, they want to show both sides. So they have one side that says that government spending and stimulus helps the economy, and then they've got some shill that says it doesn't. It's kind of like the people that say, climate change is happening, and then you have someone that says climate change isn't happening. You have someone that says 2 + 2 = 4, and then to be balanced, you have someone that says 2 + 2 = 5. They don't actually – when facts coincide with politics, they want to show both sides, and so they'll show truth and a lie as if they're equal positions, whereas in economic theory – I don't think there's any even conservative economist that would deny that government spending stimulates the economy.
No, there isn't. And, you know, I recently spoke to a guy who had been John McCain's principal economic advisor in the 2008 campaign. And he said to me, oh, we would have done the same stimulus that you guys did.
Of course.
It's absolutely true. I think the media is actually not trying to be even-handed. I think what they're trying to do is get fights going.
Because they're better for the ratings.
Because the conflict is what drives viewership.
But in the process, people are being misinformed.
Absolutely. And they're being misinformed. They're being misled. And they're paying the price. You know, they're paying the price in slower growth and slower gains in income. And look, in an economy which, for reasons we only partly understand, has shifted the distribution of income way up the ladder.
Certainly has, and that's why when Sean Hannity was complaining to me today in a pre-recorded broadcast that'll be played live on my website, go to marklevintalk.com, he was saying, you know, I pay enough taxes. I said, you know what, Sean, you live a privileged life. You make tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. Do you care at all about anybody else other than yourself? I guess the answer is no, but that's a conservative theory. Thank you very much, Rob Shapiro. This was a fascinating discussion. Sure, you told me things that I already believed, but you gave it the imprimatur of a really smart guy in academia, former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs. Leslie Marshall will be with me in the next hour. Stay tuned, 888-653-7543.
Hey there, America. How are you? Good afternoon. Happy hump day. I'm Leslie Marshall. Welcome or welcome back. Only true democracy in talk radio of for and by you, the people. Hey, we're live on the radio nationwide, and we're streaming live throughout the world on the World Wide Web. Check it out, LeslieMarshallShow.com/stream. Now, keep in mind, live stream means that we're only streaming when the show is live, and that's Monday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Good afternoon. Also carried on every military base throughout the world on the American Armed Forces Radio Network. We're carried on the Progressive Voices Network. ProgressiveVoices.com is how you find it. Indiana Talks, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and also free podcasts are available through iHeartRadio's Spreaker division. Go to Spreaker.com. That's Spreaker, Spreaker.com/Leslie Marshall. Just follow me there and you can get the show when you want, where you want, the way you want, absolutely free if you've missed any of it. And if you miss a little, you miss a lot. In this and every hour, we encourage, I invite, and I want to hear from you. I was on vacation, then I was back, then I had to go out of town, something unavoidable, and I'm back, and I'm glad to be back. Missed all of you. I hope you will join us in this and next hour. In this hour, I have my co-host, as I do every second hour on Wednesdays, Mark Levine. And in the third hour, why open telephones? Just you and me. Here's how you join me. 888-6-LESLIE to call me, which is 888-653-7543. You can also tweet me. Follow me on Twitter, at Leslie Marshall. Like our fan page, facebook.com/TheLeslieMarshallShow, to FB me. Or go to our website to email LeslieMarshallShow.com. Just click on contact. Joining us is Mark Levine in this hour and every second hour, every hump day, former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. He currently hosts a Washington-based radio show and television talk show. It's called The Inside Scoop, and also he hosts, co-hosts the Ruckus Caucus on Pacifica Radio, WPFW 89.3 FM inside the Beltway. He appears on TV on Fox, like me, MSNBC, CNN, Fox Biz, and CNBC. He tangles with everyone from Bill O'Reilly on the right to his Pacifica co-host on the left, and when it comes to some issues, me as well. Mark, happy hump day. Thanks for covering me this past hour, and thank you for being with me in this hour. As always, lots and lots and lots to talk about. Let's get to it, and let's start with a biggie, climate change. A few things going on. A UN panel has found that global warming is human-caused. I think we have enough evidence to ensure that. It's also dangerous. And now we have a lot of Republicans getting on the president because he knows he doesn't have 67 votes in the Senate to get his international treaty. but he has legal ways to go around that, and we'll talk about that in just a bit, by an internationally binding agreement. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's talk about global warming. UN panel says global warming is here, is caused by humans, is dangerous. First of all, Mark, any big surprise?
No, to me this is almost old news. They basically said what everyone's known for a decade or two now, and just put a bunch of exclamation points on it. That's not in any way to knock the conclusions of the report. It's absolutely accurate. It's to say, if you didn't know global warming was real, where have you lived in the past 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, global warming is here, human-caused, and probably already dangerous. Mark, we know that this has become, and it shouldn't be, a political issue. Why is it, let's talk about the politics of this issue. The Koch brothers, one of which, I believe David Koch, is a huge, huge Darwinist. He and he believes heavily in science. It's disingenuous for these two men, these brothers, the Koch brothers, to pretend climate change doesn't exist. I mean, you know, historically, especially, I believe David, is a believer of this. And writing checks to people and organizations who spin a completely different truth.
Well, look, you make a lot of money by carbon pollution when you're in the fossil fuels industry. They have a fortune. They literally each have tens of billions of dollars, and they make their money off polluting our air. If we were to take action to reduce carbon emissions, that would hurt their bottom line. So whether or not Charles or David Koch believes the science or not, or sometimes people amazingly can persuade themselves to believe things that they know are false, but, you know, humans can do that with rationalization. Either way, the point is that he makes a lot of money by denying the obvious, kind of like those tobacco companies that for a long time denied that cigarettes cause smoking.
Very true. Very true. This UN panel stating this, will that help to silence some of the naysayers, do you think? But, you know, who really have a hard time believing in climate change, or even people out there who do believe in climate change, have a hard time with the next step, which is that we humans caused this. So first of all, the UN panel findings, will that change the minds of some, or do you think no, especially because this has been thrown into the political arena and become such a polarized issue left and right?
I don't think any serious scientist or politician can deny that climate change is real or that humans caused it. The more interesting question, I think, is what to do about it. And there you may have reasonable differences. You could argue that this thing helps but harms the economy less, or this way of dealing with climate change is more effective than another, or it's unfair that the U.S. does things that China or India doesn't do. That's actually where I think conservative liberals will end up 5-10 years from now. The idea that it doesn't exist, that's just silly. Everyone knows that it does. But how to deal with it? I think that actually is a fair political question.
Yeah, and we'll even talk about some of this stuff in just a minute more specifically. Why do you think some people have an issue with humans causing it? Why is that? I mean, if you can grasp climate change, which to me it's, just look at the photos that NASA took. They said that 5 years ago, they expected the Antarctic shelf to melt at a faster rate, and some of the glaciers in that area of our planet. And now there are photos from NASA, you know, many of which that were just released in the past day or two, that show the rate of melting and erosion is more than double the expectation that had been predicted 5 years ago. So, and NASA is not a democratic organization by any means.
Right. That's really the scary thing. It's not just the global warming's happening, but apparently the scientists have underestimated it. I mean, think about it. For all of human history, the North Pole has been frozen. It has been ice. It has been a place. But soon we could have the Arctic Sea. We really could have the Arctic Ocean not be the Arctic ice cap anymore. Just look at pictures of the Arctic. For any doubters, look at pictures of the Arctic ice cap in 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000. Just look each year. So 2010, 2011, 2012. It's obvious to all but the blind. And the reason why people have trouble admitting it is very simple, because humans make a lot of profits off of polluting our air. And when you make a lot of money doing something, you don't want to focus on the negative effects. I think that's all it is.
When we look at this, though, I mean, yes, there's profit, but many of these people profiting have children, have grandchildren, have families, have mothers, have grandmothers, husbands, wives, and quite frankly, are, you know, breathing in the result of a high carbon emission in wealthy countries like our own, in addition to, you know, the fish that we ate from the water and the water that we drink, no matter how much filtering goes through. I mean, really, does the greed supersede any, you know, health issues? Because, I mean, I think that going forward, we're going to find more and more health issues, cancers as examples, that are tied into various elements of climate change.
I think it's two things. One is greed, but the other is the fact that it's hard to see. You know, the temperature changes from winter to summer, some 60 or 80 degrees even, from the coldest of the winter to the heat of the summer, 3-4 degree change that all the climatologists say is happening over the course of year to year. So we don't see it as that big a problem because it's not before our eyes. When Japan has a tsunami and has an earthquake, that we notice. When California has a drought, that we notice. But climate change, even if it's causing all these things, the actual increase in temperature is just not big enough for people to take notice of, and so they choose to believe it's not happening.
Oh, absolutely. Guys, do we have to take a break, or do we have a minute or two more? Huh? I'm sorry? Okay, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. Mark Levine is my guest / co-host in this hour, every hour at 2, every Wednesday. This is the Leslie Marshall Show. I am she. He's in D.C. I'm in L.A. We'll take a break, and we'll be back. Where are you? Who are you? And what's your take on climate change? And quite frankly, that this U.N. panel has said, look, it is here. It is real. It's caused by humans. And by the way, it is very dangerous. Do you believe it? And when you have findings like this that don't come from a political source, you know, it's not left or right, it's not Democrat or Republican, does it change your mind a bit if you were a bit on the fence on this? Or do you believe in climate change but don't believe it's caused by humans? Why? And why is it hard for you to wrap your head around humans causing it? And does it bother you that major corporations and wealthy individuals in the wealthiest nations in the world, including our own, are getting rich and harming not just our environment, but all of our lives, our kids' lives, and future generations? Pick up the phone and join me. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. Join us. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. And follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. We'll share your tweets, your calls, and more right after this. How you doing? Happy hump day. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine, my co-host every hour two here on the Leslie Marshall Show, my partner in crime. And Mark, thanks for holding and welcome back. We have various issues to talk about. So let's continue on a little bit just for the shortest segment in this hour with the findings of the UN panel. Once again, if you've just tuned in, the UN has said global warming is real. It's here. It is caused by humans, and it is probably already dangerous. Also, it's increasingly likely that the heating trend could be irreversible. And this is according to a draft of a new international science report. It is part of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they sent governments a final draft of this report. They sent this out 2 days ago to governments worldwide, obviously UN governments, and they actually are confirming, reiterating, and then combining three earlier documents that are gigantic by the Nobel Prize-winning group. Now, Mark, there's little in the report that wasn't in the other more detailed version. So some people are saying this is much ado about nothing. This is same old, same old. This is no new revelation. Is there any new revelation, or do you think the NASA photos that I mentioned last segment are the biggest, newest revelation that should make people stand up and take notice?
First of all, people should have taken notice before. So in that sense, there's not much new, but there is a little bit new. One is that the fact that it may be irreversible is even more scary than we thought. I'm waiting now for Republicans to say, well, it's too late, it's already there, it's irreversible. Of course, it can get worse. Just because we can't reverse the problems we've had doesn't mean things can't get worse. So I think that's new, but certainly I think the best way to persuade anybody about global warming is just those photos, whether of the Arctic Circle or of the Antarctic Circle. Either way, our ice caps are melting very, very fast, even faster than Al Gore predicted in An Inconvenient Truth. And they called him an alarmist. He actually turns out to have been a prophet.
Let's talk further about danger, dangerous, so that people understand. You know, you and I aren't Nobel scientists, and
that's true
by any stretch. So I think it's easier for people to understand for people who perhaps aren't Nobel scientists, but just regular, you know, Joe and Jane here, or Mark and Leslie. Mark, so in layperson terms, why does it matter to humankind that these glaciers and that the Arctic shelf is melting at this fast a rate? What does that mean? Not everybody saw An Inconvenient Truth, and not everybody fully understands it. Some people are afraid by scientific terminology, and climate change to them is, you know, one big part of science class, which a lot of people wanted to avoid.
Well, first of all, if you live anywhere near a coast or a body of water, you should be concerned, because the water level goes up, and that includes New York, Boston, Miami, Los Angeles. Most of our American cities are on the coast. In fact, Leslie, you have more to worry about in L.A. than I do in D.C. I'm inland a bit, but we have rivers that can rise, so that's big. Another thing that's big is that agriculture will completely change. We already have a very dry areas. Actually, you in California, Leslie, traditionally have droughts. Those droughts will get worse. If you suffer from hurricanes or tornadoes, those get worse. So you have all kinds of patterns that are changing. You know, humankind, when it dealt with the last ice age tens of thousands of years ago, we didn't have culture and civilization and people living in beachfront homes. We have modern society now. And just look at all the tremendous costs the Netherlands has to do to keep the oceans from rising. Now suddenly all of us have to start building dikes. It's not just New Orleans and the Netherlands anymore. It's virtually anywhere on the coast.
He wanted to share some tweets. John tweets that climate change is propaganda and lies. The climate debate is about money and power only. Mark, who benefits more financially and politically? Those on the left, Democrats, who are saying, look, people, this is real. We got to do something about it. Or people on the right who are saying, no, you know, don't worry, calm down. Where I sit, it looks like the rich corporations, you know, who are writing checks to the Republicans, are making money lying to people. Where do Democrats benefit, quite frankly, other than, yeah, maybe they won't get some checks from some environmentalist groups, but Save the Gray Wolf doesn't have anywhere near the money of the Koch brothers.
Yeah, I don't think the Sierra Club has as much money as Exxon, or
money
as Exxon. Actually, the political choice, the wise choice, if you want to make a lot of money as a politician, is to deny global warming. That's the political choice. It happens to be scientifically false, but if you don't care, you just want to make a lot of money, sure, deny it.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back. He's Mark Levine. I'm Leslie Marshall. Pick up the phone and join us. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Follow me on Twitter to tweet me there, at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. Quick break. We'll be back in topic two in the second half of this hour. Don't go away. We are back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. He's in Washington, D.C. I'm in Los Angeles, California. We want to know where you are, but we also want to get your take. Pick up the phone and join us. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543 is the number. Mark, you and I were going to talk about something, and then we switching gears at my request. I was on television this morning on The Real Story with Gretchen Carlson, as I am every Wednesday, and I was, as a Fox News contributor, one of the libs there, and I was sitting in the makeup room getting my hair and makeup done, you know, so they, you know, make me, you know, improve my appearance from regular day to, whoo, cameras, lights, cameras, action. And I was sitting there, and I could not, I almost thought it was a very bad joke when I heard a soundbite coming up about a 9-year-old little girl who shot her instructor, her shooting instructor, with a semi-automatic weapon, a semi-automatic assault weapon. And of course, first of all, I thought, one, what is a 9-year-old little girl doing learning how to shoot an assault weapon? One. Two, I understand times are tough and people want money, but who in their right mind would teach a 9-year-old to shoot with a semi-assault weapon? You know, I'm scuba certified, and I don't think they let you even try to get scuba certified when you're 12 years of age, until you're 12 years of age. There are shooting ranges that are allowing 9-year-olds target practice. There are instructors that are teaching 9-year-olds how to use guns. And it's not just the guns, it's the type of gun here. This blew my mind, no pun intended. Mark, were you as shocked, upset, appalled, and outraged as I was at the revelation of this this little girl? And not to mention the this 9-year-old little girl who's learning how to shoot a gun has killed her instructor, an adult who she is bonded with, has seen death at 9 years of age, has seen the destruction a weapon can cause. That is something she will never get out of her mind. This is mentally and emotionally damaging, especially to a 9-year-old. I mean, there are 9-year-olds that can't fully grasp and understand and don't want to. Death, the finality of that. I could go on and on, but I'll shut up for a second. Go ahead, Mark, your take.
You know, when people train lions and then they're eaten by that lion, I feel bad for them, but at some point I do think, well, you knew it was a dangerous profession. People who jump out of planes for a living, I obviously I don't want them to die, but I feel like, well, you know, that's the profession you chose. When you teach a 9-year-old girl how to fire one of the single most deadly weapon you can legally buy in America, and without being a cop, and then she turns around and accidentally shoots you, you know, I don't want to say you had it coming because that's not nice and not fair, but let's just say people shouldn't be teaching 9-year-olds to shoot with this massive weaponry. I don't even think we should be treating 9-year-olds, frankly, to shoot handguns, much less this very, very powerful weapon.
By the way, I saw when I was waiting, I saw it on Fox. This is on video. Okay.
Yeah, I saw the video.
I
saw it yesterday.
Right. And on the video, the instructor, the firing range instructor, tells her, quote, all right, full auto. And he's telling her, a 9-year-old girl, she braces the Uzi submachine gun. An Uzi submachine gun. What the hell does a 9-year-old need an Uzi submachine gun for? First of all, what does a 9-year-old need that type of weaponry for and need to learn how to use that type of weaponry for? This is a little girl in Arizona. I mean,
In Newtown, Connecticut, when they said that those kindergartners, that the reason so many of those 5- and 6-year-old kids died was because not enough people had guns. And I remember thinking, do you want the kindergartners to have guns? The first graders to have guns? Is that really what we're going to have now? A shootout over hopscotch? The stupidity, you know, again, somebody died, so you don't want it. But, oh, my God, maybe this will be a wake-up call to people all across the country that people should be of a certain age, at least, I don't know, be a teenager and learn. I don't know. These guns are very, very powerful. I don't think anyone under 18, I don't think these guns should be legal, but at the very least, no one under 18 should be handling them, period.
I agree.
Unless you're in the military.
Oh, I agree.
So, you know, I don't know. It's maybe they'll shut these places down. I mean, you're giving a 9-year-old a weapon? I mean, they're kids that play with guns because they look fun, and now you're going to, she's going to now, I mean, before this, she tells her friends, hey, you know, I got to shoot this really powerful weapon. I want to do it. Because kids like to try things. But a gun like that is not a video game. It's a very deadly weapon.
Absolutely. We're going to take some calls, but I just want to share that she braces the Uzi submachine gun. She opens fire. She's opening fire at a black silhouette target. The recoil wrenches the fully automatic weapon upward. This is another thing that there are people out there who say they can't handle this type of a, this type of a gun, right? And the instructor is shot in the head and killed. Obviously, this sets off, again, another debate, a powerful debate over youngsters and guns. There are many people wondering, and I'm one of them, as a mother of a 6- and 7-year-old, what sort of parents would let a child handle an Uzi submachine gun, and why? Why?
It takes physical strength, as you point out, to handle a gun. The recoil is powerful. It's shooting an extremely powerful bullet out. You know, basic physics, a very powerful reaction is coming the other way. And if you're not strong enough to handle it, it was completely foreseeable this was going to happen.
I know, I agree. And this is why the instructor and the place where they were allowing this to take place, look, I understand teaching children about guns if you have guns in the home. I'm anti-gun. But I don't want to take anybody's Second Amendment right away. You do have the right to bear arms for a well-regulated militia. But if you do have the mindset that you're part of this well-regulated fantasy militia, then, you know, you do have a Second Amendment constitutional right to buy a gun. And I understand if you have children, you want to teach them about the guns and so they can learn to use them and so that they respect them and what they are and how dangerous they can be. I get that. But an Uzi submachine gun? Is there a war in Arizona? I'm not aware. And if people call me and talk about Mexican drug cartels, I don't see 9-year-olds in Arizona. And I go to Arizona often. I don't see people, in Arizona, arming their children in this capacity. What does she need that for? To kill other children coming over the border? I'm so upset by this.
That's the thing. These guns are not used for hunting.
Exactly. So what is that child being taught to shoot at?
I don't know.
Are these parents teaching their child to kill human beings? That's murder. That's illegal. And speaking of, should the this poor child's going to be a mess. Do you think the parents should be arrested for child abuse or neglect? Or do you think the parents, Mark, you're the lawyer here. Are there any charges? Could the family of Charles Vaca, 39 years of age, the instructor who was shot standing next to that little girl Monday at the Last Stop outdoor shooting range in White Hills, Arizona, that's about 25 miles south of Vegas, when she squeezed that trigger, could his family sue her parents or even sue that shooting range?
She actually could even be criminally responsible, although she probably won't be. The way the law works is if you're 7 and under, you have zero criminal responsibility. You could take that Uzi, shoot 100 people dead. If you're 7, you get off scot-free. Not that I'm recommending it for any 7-year-old. If you're 15 or older, you can be tried as an adult, and it's very frequent that kids age 15, 16, and 17 are tried for an adult. You do a drug thing with that Uzi, and you're going to be in real trouble. The 8 to 14 range is the middle range, and that's the range where a court would look at and see who you are and how intelligent you are, how strong you are, and how willing you are. And, a 12-year-old that plots mass murder can go to jail for a long time, whereas a 13-year-old that accidentally kills someone may not suffer responsibility at all. That whole 8 to 14 range, it would go to a court. She is 9. It is actually conceivable. For example, if she, it recoiled, it was an accident, but if she intentionally turned around and shot the guy in the head, and then it was shown that she had written in her diary that she wants to
to kill people. She could be. Now, in this case, she almost certainly won't be held criminally responsible. But yes, I think her parents can be. If you have a dangerous dog, for example, and you know that it bites people, and you let it out on the street and it bites someone, you can be held responsible for it because you knew better. And in this case, I think everyone, frankly, the gun instructor could be responsible, but it's his own death. So, you know, it's probably no one will sue anyone because he's more responsible than anyone. He knew better than anyone these guns recoil. He knew better than anyone that it shouldn't be put in the hand of a small child. And frankly, I think the greatest fault for his death is his own. But sure, her parents could bear some responsibility. If this is, let's say she didn't shoot the instructor. Let's say she shot another child nearby. Then I'd have a much better case to sue the parents.
Let's go to Joe in Denver, line one. Joe, your take. How you doing? Good afternoon.
Hey, yeah, good. Thank you. I just wanted, I think you're doing what so many people usually do and creating a ton of straw man arguments when you say, why does a 9-year-old need an Uzi? Need has nothing to do with it. I can't think of anybody who is claiming that a 9-year-old needs that. And when you bring up arguments like that, you're implying that that's what the other side, i.e. my side, I guess, is, thinks that 9-year-olds, quote, need this. And look, I've been shooting guns. I'm over 50. I've shot guns since I was 10 years old. And, you know, this, I would never let my 9-year-old shoot a submachine gun. I think it is irresponsible of the parents. I think it's maybe irresponsible of the place that was doing it. But everything that's irresponsible does not need to be illegal. You know, if somebody let their 9-year-old get a hold of a car and drove their car and it rode over somebody and killed somebody, would that mean all of a sudden there would be arguments, well, let's ban cars. Why do 9-year-olds need cars? You know, nobody's saying 9-year-olds need cars or need machine guns. You know, and this constant drumbeat, you know, I hate to say it, but you're not so much you, but I've listening to some other people on the Progressive Network, and they're almost this morbid glee that this accident happened because they want to use this to taint the other side as some sort of lunatic fringe that is in love with guns and all this kind of stuff. And they create these straw men. You know, the left is supposed to be so open-minded that if, you know, people have different likes, you can completely enjoy target shooting. I mean, when you say it's not for hunting, hunting has nothing to do with it. I don't want to get into a Second Amendment argument. Hunting, nothing, there's nothing in the Second Amendment about hunting. Hunting has, and why do people,
and there's nothing
on the left,
about target practice,
why do people on the left always bring up hunting?
There is nothing, but thank you. You're supporting our argument. Let's take a break, and we'll be back. If Joe has more to say, we'll let him come. Joe, hang on. We got to take a break. I don't control time. I'm a control freak, and I'd like to, but unfortunately, I can't control time. But we're not getting rid of you. We're taking a break. We'll be right back. Mark Levine in Washington, D.C. We're talking about this terrible, terrible shooting of an instructor, a shooting instructor by a 9-year-old girl. It certainly has stirred the debate over guns. That doesn't need much stirring with all the gun issues that have gone on. Instructor Charles Baca, who was 39, standing next to this little 9-year-old girl, teaching her to shoot an Uzi submachine gun. And there are a lot of questions, such as what sort of parents would let a child handle an Uzi, and why did this shooting range in White Hills, Arizona, about 25 miles south of Vegas, allow that? The man who actually operates the shooting range is a former Lake Havasu City Council member. His name is Sam Scarmato. He said the girl's parents signed waivers saying they understood the rules of the range and were standing nearby. As a matter of fact, they were the ones video recording their daughter when the accident happened. And he said, I quote, "I have regret we let this child shoot, and I have regret that Charlie was killed in the incident." So, dude, don't let children shoot. And if you're going to teach children to shoot, don't let them shoot weaponry like this. By the way, this is not the first accidental shooting by a child using an Uzi. An 8-year-old boy died after shooting himself in the head, you ready? You ready? Are you ready? Are you all ready for it? You ready? At a gun expo near Springfield, Massachusetts. And that was in 2008. His name was Christopher I'm going to pronounce it wrong, and I apologize in advance, Bezalelish. He was firing at pumpkins, and what happened? The exact same thing. The Uzi kicked back. It recoiled. According to a Phoenix-based firearm safety expert, most shooting ranges have an age limit and strict safety rules when teaching children to shoot. His name is Ronald Scott. He is a firearm safety expert. He said instructors usually have their hands on the guns when children are firing high-powered weapons. Even he says, and agrees with us, Mark, you can't give a 9-year-old an Uzi and expect her to control it. Same with that 8-year-old in Springfield, Mass. In 2008. Let's get back, Mark, your response to Joe. I know Joe is still with us. Joe in Denver, line one. Bring him back on, guys, if you could. Joe, thank you for holding. Welcome back. I want Mark.
No problem.
Mark had started before the break to respond to what you were saying, and I think you're helping the liberal argument where the Second Amendment really, you know, doesn't allow you to bear arms to hunt, technically.
I wasn't sure he was finished, so I want to make sure he has a chance to finish what he was saying.
Go ahead.
I mean, this is a recreational accident, and the fact that you had to go all the way back to 2008 to find one other incident proves how safe it is. In fact, if you're willing to look at the statistics, per accidental deaths under the age of 15, a swimming pool is 5.6 times more dangerous to children than our guns.
Joe, wait. I have a swimming pool. I don't have a gun in my home. I don't lose sleep. Wait. I don't lose sleep at night with my swimming pool outside and my kids who know how to swim and been taught how to swim and been taught what they do need to do when they fall in the pool. Here's the big difference. My kids can't pull my swimming pool out of the ground and go to school and kill somebody with it. They can a gun.
Are you worried about children dying in accidental death?
I'm worried. I'm actually more worried about the increasing amount of people that have guns and the increasing school shootings and the increasing level of violence caused by guns in America, more so than the accidental deaths.
Well, then you're not looking at it. You just got done with a whole big global
They're apples warming. And oranges, sweetheart.
No, they're not.
How many children do you have?
Two.
Okay, I have two as well. Do you have a gun in your home?
Several.
Okay, how old are your children?
Right now, 14 and 18.
Okay, well, the 14-year-old is closer to that 9-year-old's age. When your 14-year-old son or daughter was 9, would you have let them and taught them
use? No, in fact, I said before I won't, and I started shooting when I was 10.
Right, but did you need to learn to shoot? Tell me the reason any child should be taught how to use an Uzi submachine gun.
Well, why should a child be allowed to ride a go-kart? This is recreation.
His point is that it's fun. And my point is that a gun is different from a go-kart.
It is fun to shoot an Uzi submachine gun? Maybe that's why we have so many kids going into schools and killing people. It's fun.
Look, it's fun. You don't think it's fun, right?
No, I do not.
You have a typical
I don't think the destruction, I don't think destroying things is fun. Guns were created to destroy.
Whether it's
human life or animal life, I don't think it's fun. No offense to you personally, but when I was not married and I was dating, if a guy was a hunter, I wanted nothing to do with him. Because to me, somebody that takes pleasure in destroying life, I don't get that. My husband works 100-hour weeks as a surgeon saving lives, many of which are caused at the hands of a gun. Oh, my God, we're out of time already in this hour. Mark, I love you. You know you'll be back, and we'll be back together. We'll be back together now that we're breaking up next week. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine.